Hello, welcome to Sinner Saint Sister. This is a space where searching, hurting, faithful, curious people come together and ask hard questions and listen to wise guests share how they have lived life deeply. There are a couple of things that you can do that really help out the show. One of them is if this episode is something that blesses you, can you please send it to a friend? Another thing is that if you really liked it, then could you please leave a 5-star review and write something nice? You can follow along at YouTube/Allison Sullivan for some really fun extras. Find me on Instagram at Allison M. Sully and TikTok at Sullivan Family TikTok. Thanks for being here. I hope you hear something today that lets you know you are loved and helps you love one another. Welcome to Sinner Saint Sister. I was asked to lead a 5-minute body scan at a retreat in an effort before we began our soul searching to maybe turn one thing down and listen more closely to another. What do our bodies have to say? A body scan, it can help us to be present with what is rather than what the mind thinks should or should not be. We can experience something without our mind jumping to some conclusion about it. A practice in presence, observance. Someone found me after the practice, and she said she had a confession for me. I couldn't tell if she was mad at me or happy with me. I was waiting. She said, "I need you to know that I didn't feel relaxed or peaceful at all during that practice." "Okay," I said. I felt agitated and annoyed. "Okay," I said, and smiled. When I smiled, I think she felt the space to ask, "Does that make you angry?" And when I said that it didn't, she asked if she could hug me. When I said yes, she leaned in and cried into my shoulder. With certainty, she said, she knew that she had been avoiding her body. Put plainly, she said she hated it. She grew up with a stick-thin sister and felt left out of the beautiful club. As she was led through the practice, she kept noticing, she told me, a disengagement. The group was given permission to gently observe when the mind wandered and then just lovingly bring it back to focus using their breath. She followed directions accordingly, but she became curious about her tendency to wander. She wasn't usually so distractible. When she got beneath her distraction, she found a discomfort. When she dissected that discomfort, she excavated one word, rejection. What is the opposite of rejection, she thought. In the meditation, I said the word bicep. She noticed she immediately disengaged. She hates her arms. She tries with great effort to keep them covered all the time. In the meditation, I said the word thighs, and her mind immediately ran away as quickly as it could. Without judgment, just awareness, she brought her mind back to the present. And then she heard the words breathe out acceptance. What is the opposite of rejection, she thought. Acceptance? Acceptance of her body? Acceptance of her sister's body? Acceptance of her mother's judgment? Acceptance of the way that she had rejected her very self? Acceptance of more holy work to do towards greater love? My new friend observed for the first time ever a detailed list of rejections that she's lived with so long that she never even considered them individually, just generally as one sweeping dismissal. Cover. Shame, disengage, stay the same. My new friend taught me that we truly heal when we mourn our losses, not in general, but in particular. Our heart breaks itself over the little things, and maybe we pass them up because they seem silly or ignoble or frivolous or dramatic, but love is always in the details, and healing likely is too. Dr. Hillary McBride is here, an expert on embodiment, and you're going to love this conversation. Hello, Dr. Hillary McBride. I am so excited to have you here. And if I can, I'd like to tell you exactly why, because there's a very specific reason.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
So I am a yoga instructor, and I started off learning about embodiment because it was something that I wanted to do for other people.
Sounds familiar.
It was, yeah. Yes. I wanted them to have a more meaningful experience in my class. And as I did that over the years, I started to slowly become more and more aware that this work was for me, that embodiment was something that I needed for myself, for everyone needs for themselves. And I was discovering that just because I didn't have a certain type of trauma, it didn't mean that I didn't need healing. Or just because I didn't have an eating disorder didn't mean that I wasn't ignoring or punishing or blaming my body.
Right.
And so if I was starting to get a clue as a yoga instructor that I was living disembodied, it was your work, Dr. Hillary McBride, that just kicked that door open. Actually, I'd like to take that back if I can, because I hate to use the word kicked open with anything that you're doing, because there is nothing forceful about it. It is so welcoming and warm and alluring and comfortable and inviting. You are a fuzzy blanket. You are a warm cup of tea. And I am so thrilled to have you here. Your work has meant so much to me. Welcome to Center St. Sister.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so touched to know that my work has mattered to you. That feels so warm inside of me. Thank you for naming that.
I bet that is so fun for you to hear from strangers everywhere that what you're doing just matters so deeply.
It's always, yeah, lovely to hear. Thank you.
So you are a registered psychologist. You are an award-winning researcher, a host of Other People's Problems, a podcast, which, by the way, New York Times and Wall Street Journal says is a must listen. You're a speaker and retreat leader, and you have written Mother's Daughter's Body Image and the bestseller, Wisdom of Your Body. And today we are here to discuss practices for embodied living. And if that's the black and white introduction, which I don't mean to make less of because it's incredible and amazing, I would love for you to color it in, if you will, by telling us a little bit about who and what you love.
Sure. I was thinking about this recently when someone was asking me about being a researcher. And I remember thinking, yeah, I'm a researcher because I really like the research process. And that's something kind of procedural that I do in my work. But actually, I think I'm a researcher because I love questions and I love curiosity and being on the edge of unfolding knowing. When you're stepping into spaces where something isn't concretized yet, and you can kind of wonder about it and see what emerges. So that's something that I love, is being right on the edge of what I know and what is known, and really being curious about the world. And I also love the ocean. I am having a particular kind of, I don't know, what mystical love affair with this apple tree in my backyard that keeps teaching me all sorts of lessons about motherhood and embodiment and the seasons and generativity and intergenerational, yeah, I would say providence in some way. So yeah, there's all of these surprising things that keep informing me about who I am in the world. And for sure, those are some of them. And then of course, I don't even have a word. I was going to say obsessed. I think it's the right word. I'm obsessed with my daughter. I'm obsessed with her. Oh yeah. My gosh. I'm obsessed. It's the only word to describe it. Really, it is. So
it's the most flattening love I've ever known is my motherhood. It wrecks me. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I love all of those answers. I just want to scooch closer to all of them. The ocean and an apple tree and curiosity and children. There's not much better than that. So I mentioned that I am a yoga instructor, and I would say that my primary goal as a yoga instructor is to bring our whole being into harmony. And so we might, if we have our mind and our body and our spirit, we might live with the volume turned way up in one area. Maybe it's our cognition. And then the volume turned way down on perhaps our bodies. Maybe our spirits and emotions kind of hover right in the middle somewhere. But as a yoga instructor, it's my hope that students end their time in class just a little more level, like all things kind of coming into level, and then going about our days perhaps as God intended, with all parts of us informing each other. I'm wondering if you might give us a little bit of insight, what you've learned about why it is we rely on our cognition so readily.
Yeah, I love that question. I think that there are a couple of reasons, and I'll try to speak from academic evidence and empirical evidence, as well as from theory and practical experience and my own lived knowing. But I think that we live, particularly, I'm saying this as a woman socialized into kind of the white identity in a Western context, which is often patriarchal and androcentric, that I think we've been swimming in a cultural water that says that's the best way to be, right? To be over-identified in a way with your mind. And in fact, that's the only way to be. And then we layer on top of that, we kind of have this extra additional baggage of certain faith contexts, which actually tell us that being in your body is a really bad place to be, that it's dangerous, that it's problematic, that it'll keep you away from the God that you love. So we've got culture on culture on culture. And then I think we can get into the specifics of both our life and intergenerationally as well, that trauma, that overwhelming intensity in the body can also make it very difficult to be in the body, that sometimes the body is the living memory of what we've survived. Mm-hmm. And the way that the body communicates that is through sensation and reaction and emotion and pain. And what we might typically call symptoms, but I would often refer to as kind of stories in a way. So our body is telling these stories of what we've lived through and perhaps what our ancestors have lived through. I know now we have enough research about epigenetics and intergenerational trauma to understand that sometimes what's living through my body, what story my body is telling is actually the story of my people, the story of the people I've come from. So when we look at the body as being the place where all of that is held, of course there's access to resilience in the body. Of course there's access to resource, but often what screams the loudest, especially if we haven't been taught to support it or identify it or be with it, is the memory of the pain, the memory of the trauma, the living reminder of what we've survived. And that can make it pretty difficult to be in the body. And I'm not just referring to this as, you know, a choice that, you know, imagining a typical person sitting in their living room one day and feeling lots of pain in their body and thinking to themselves for the first time ever, you know what? I'm going to turn all of this off and I'm going to go live in my mind. It's not usually super hyper-rational like that or linear in a decision-making process, but rather we have this accumulated load, this allostatic load of intensity that's inside of us meeting culture that says, don't feel it. It's not good. Actually, it's better if you're in your mind, meeting probably a paucity of resources about how to stay with what's intense in our body. And you have this kind of confluence of factors that results in it just being somehow safer or more superior to be in the mental place. And then we get, you know, people get lauded for that. People are often praised for being moral or being spiritually mature, perhaps people being strong, right? We think about the mind over matter narrative that's in our culture. Think of how often people who are really good at putting mind over matter get rewarded for disavowing the body's cues, right? For conquering them in some way. You get to do amazing feats. You get to work long hours. You get to be really impressive. You get to have this ideal body, whatever it is that our culture tends to celebrate. And I think that there's this reinforcing loop as people become further disembodied in a culture that values that, that we get praised for it and it feels good. And so we do more of it.
Wow. What a really thorough answer. As I'm listening, I'm hearing a lot of words that sound really good, like safety and protection and acclaim, you know, that's so interesting. Because I like to read good writing and I also try to write well myself, I can sometimes get really attached to words and appreciating the right words or finding them. And so I recognize this cognitive process, and yet I know that there are very important things in the world and to me that there are simply no words for, that there isn't good language for. And those things that I can't name, that I might not just have good explanations around. For example, there are certain people, you're certainly one of them, that just make me want to exhale and scooch closer to. And that is something that is very much in my body. That is something that I very much feel, that there's no cognition around it. Actually, can I give another quick example?
Yeah, I'd love
because
to hear
it. So I was cleaning out a cabinet that was under my bathroom sink. So it's just like shoved in with hair dryers and curling irons I don't use and old travel bags that I had just thrown. And so as I was going through travel bags and realizing like, oh, that's where that went, or this is where that pair of earrings were, I pulled out a perfume that I had forgotten about. And it was a perfume that I wore, as best I can know, is that it was pre-pandemic. Because when I smelled it, it was a smell that was free of that. It was free of everything that came after. It was as though there was this marking point of pandemic, quarantine, and that smell represented BP before pandemic. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it. It was just something my body knew that felt like peace, I guess. And so I guess my point in sharing all that is that when I started with learning what embodiment was, it was a practice in presence. It was really just to be more attuned so that we could go about our lives paying more holy attention to what it was that God had put in front of us that day. But it wasn't about wisdom. My pursuit of embodiment wasn't necessarily about wisdom. And so I have only slowly started to become aware that my body is wise. And I know that you have so much work around that. I know it's a big question, but could you get more specific about that?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many pieces of that. I'm trying to decide, even as you're saying this, which direction to go in. But maybe a counter example or an additional example to what you suggested already takes us in that direction, that, you know, how many times have we had experiences the opposite of the perfume example, where we get into a room with someone and we go, mm-mm-mm, I don't like how this feels.
Yeah.
Right. There's something in my body and I can't put a finger on it and I can't identify the language around it. And I couldn't even, you know, really articulate if someone asked me why, but there's a sense inside of me that, yeah, that there's something that feels off in this room, in this moment, in this person. Mm-hmm. And it's that spectrum of everything from the memory of a time that felt uncontaminated with the complexity that we know now, all the way to the experiences that tell us, move away, right? Move away from what's happening right here. This doesn't feel good for you. Mm-hmm. It's our body's ability to give us direction, to tell stories that actually defy our conscious awareness, to move in the direction of flourishing and survival, even when the stories that we hold about ourselves are so limited that we can't even imagine that version for ourselves. It's like our bodies have within them the potential for flourishing. In fact, when we're actually looking at what's actually our kind of our factory setting, so to speak, about the body, we would say that it's an orientation to be better than fine. That there is an orientation for us to do more than just survive, and that is actually wired into our biology, and our biology actually directs us towards interpersonal biology, which is the way that we need connection in order to continue to expand ourselves and to flourish and to be in these states of aliveness. And so I think it's, you know, there's these little sprinklings of, or maybe like a breadcrumb trail that we get to encounter through our lives, that when we step back, we can see, wow, there's an instinctual knowing that comes baked into our physicality, that if only we could unlearn some of the stories that we have about our body's badness, we would be able to engage with that data, that direction, that instinct, and make meaning of it. And this is not, you know, I say this as a psychologist, quite literally, like all of my advanced degrees have been in the study of what we would call the mind, right? Like this is, I come to you having this conversation as someone who very much has also had a deep relationship with my mind in a way that has eclipsed pretty much everything else. So I love the mind. But what I found is the mind is actually a product of the body. The mind is actually the end result of, it's a very end of the line of a relational and physiological process that's happening often unconsciously in every moment within me and between us. And so whenever we're asking, we're thinking about the mind, whenever we're even looking at language, we ask, where does it come from? And it usually comes from the place of our materiality. It usually comes from the place that, you know, the way even that our structures of our brain anatomically are actually shaped by our relational experiences. So everything that's happening in our thinking is almost always the end result of all of these embodied experiences that we've had. And we can actually, right? What's so interesting is that there's this interactional relationship with them. So based on what's happened inside of us, let's just take an example. Let's make this concrete in some way. I have an experience with you that feels threatening in some way, let's say. And my body experiences the activation of that. And it shifts the way that I think about things. And then maybe I participate in a way of thinking that colludes with that terror. And my thinking says, I really am in danger with this person. They really are going to hurt me. And so my body starts creating even more physiological response to protect me from the threat. Then what's happening is this interaction between brain and body where they're fueling each other. And most of the time, this is happening, again, outside of our conscious awareness. But what I think you and I are suggesting is that actually, if we bring our awareness back into the body, then we might have more data points with which to manage the intensity of life, perhaps to steer thoughts in a different direction or create new possibilities organically for thoughts to emerge from a bottom-up place that feel more reflective of who we actually get to be in the world.
Yeah. So when I'd like to start with disembodiment, you know, there's healthy practices, which is of course what we're going to get into here in a minute. But if we're living disconnected, there are likely so many reasons for that. We've touched on a lot of them, but we disregard how they might feel because it's inconvenient or it's inefficient. Maybe we ignore or blame or punish because our bodies are scary places to be. Sometimes they're painful places to be. Do you mind getting more specific? You touched on it already, but the cultural conditioning that is facilitating that disconnection. I feel like so much of it is tied to our spirituality. So many messages are coming in saying, this is dangerous or this can't be trusted. I know that when we talk about these practices, these are ways to come back in. But a lot of times I think it's really important to get underneath what has gone wrong first so that when we do practice these things that you have for us, it is really to undo because we understand what we're undoing. So in that way, do you mind getting more specific about maybe if it's a societal response? To the ways that we're disconnecting, to the reasons why we are disconnecting.
And sorry, can you ask that again? You want me to explain disembodiment as it is a product of societal,
as
sociocultural narratives?
Yes, exactly. Because there's a lot of spiritual searchers tuning in. And I feel like there are a lot of messages that come from church and spiritual leaders that say you cannot be trusted. This is you know, and so I think that it starts early on with messages that tell us to look outside of ourselves for wisdom instead of really drawing in for wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An anecdote is coming to my mind of when I started to have a faith transition, and that looked like moving to a different church with different theological practices and beliefs and whatnot. And maybe getting more exposure to the world around me through university and graduate school and realizing, wow, I was kind of sold this story that the church was this set apart people as if they're completely distinct and removed from culture. And yet what I learned as I was getting into more and more studies about really sociocultural discourse around bodies and women's bodies in particular, I realized that the same garbage that I was being told culturally, I was often being told in the church, which is women's bodies are bad. Women's bodies need to be controlled. They're a sexed object. And, you know, often in the church, we get a little less of the use the sex object until you experience the sex object in a heterosexual marriage, right? So there's like a lot of overlap there. Bodies need to be controlled, right? There's a lot even about ableism in the church that we see parallels what happens outside of the church in terms of people seeing disability as a pathology to be managed that requires prayer and healing, which is really kind of covert ableist theology. Yeah. And so we have all of these beliefs that are situated that we're encountering in different faith contexts. And often I would say it's more concentrated and obvious in that way. You're actually being told perhaps from a pulpit or in different books that you read or in trainings, because there is such an emphasis on education in faith-based settings, right? How to educate people into right beliefs that they're directly handed to us. And these messages are often your body is bad It needs to be controlled. It is an obstacle to good spirituality. It is a barrier to knowing God, that it can't be trusted, that it leads you astray, that it's vile, that it's wicked. I mean, we could go on and on and on and on. But the reality is that when we step outside the walls of the church, we see the same narratives. They're often just a little less cloaked in spiritual language, but they're the same ideas, right? Yeah. Bodies are problems that need to be managed. And yeah. we see that as intersecting with power and privilege in pretty obvious ways in dominant culture as well, because who often gets to leave their body, right? Who gets to leave their body are the people who have the most power, who often make rules about bodies and which bodies are devalued and which bodies need to be sent away and hidden. And then who has to leave their body are the people who often don't have access to the same kind of power, who are interacting with spheres of oppression and marginalization in such a way that that compounds in the nervous system, creates yeah. overwhelming stress and trauma and requires dissociation for survival. So disembodiment, I would say again, is a pretty logical conclusion to living in the culture yeah. that we live in. In fact, yeah. as someone who promotes positive embodiment and studies it and really looks at what are the clinical resources that we can use to increase embodiment, I am like totally appreciating that disembodiment exists because it's us being good in the eyes of culture that told yeah. us don't have a body. Yeah. And so this is not something we need to shame ourselves more for or something we need to punish ourselves for, but really an appreciation for, wow, this is how we've survived. Incredible. Yeah. Look, isn't that amazing that we can do that? That we can even fracture ourselves away from ourselves so much that we convince ourselves that, you know, 90% of what it takes to make us make up who we are doesn't even exist or shouldn't be listened to. Like, whoa, those are incredible lengths that we have to go to wow. to try to survive in this culture.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's exactly what I was after. Sorry for the murky question, but that's exactly what I wanted to hit on. I really, really appreciate that.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
I'm glad. Yeah.
So do you want to know what's annoying to me?
Always. Yes. Every detail.
So I think it's annoying that nothing is ever all one thing. You know, I would really like for it to be. So let's take stress, for example. Okay. I hear stress and that sounds like something I don't want, except we know that there are certain stresses that are good. It's what keeps yeah. us interested and engaged. Yeah. Fear is obviously very functional. And I know that, you know, I just mentioned some emotions, but there are other things too. You know, people, for example, people aren't all good or all bad. It sure would make life easy if they were, because if they were all good, then we could put them on pedestals. And if they were, you know, all bad, then we could dismiss them altogether, except God keeps giving us permission to not do either. And so here we are with a mixed bag of everything. And so my question to you is disembodiment, and you, again, you touched on this already a little bit, but is disembodiment ever functional? Mm. Is it ever practiced in a healthy way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, this, as an expert in the neurophysiology of the traumatic stress response, I have to say, like, this is, again, baked into our biology
yeah.
for us to dissociate and disconnect from our bodies as a means of survival. Mm-hmm. Right? This is like, we see this in all mammals, right? It's actually not just, you know, perhaps pleasurable on some level on some occasions, but actually is the very thing that makes the difference between life and death. And when we move into the state of overwhelm, where our nervous system assesses the situation around us and says, you have no chance, right? If you throw everything at this, it's not going to get anywhere. You need to collapse to survive. Mm. You need to minimize energy distribution. You need to minimize blood flow. You need to not try in this moment because it's your only hope of living. Right? And we get this massive endogenous opiate release that floods our system, that signals different kinds of tone in the vagus nerve. And we get this whole physiological response that says, just kind of shut down. Right? That is good. That is good. Not only just like functional, but I would say, like, again, this incredible wisdom inside of us that our bodies know it to make split second decisions when assessing threats without us even consciously knowing that it's happening, to signal it's going to cost you too much if you stay in the game here. So I'm going to take you away, right? I'm going to take you away from coding this memory. I'm going to take you away from feeling the emotion. I'm going to take you away from remembering this even happened, because you won't know how to survive if you do. So like, there is incredible, I feel awe actually when I think about it.
Yeah.
Like such gratitude for this wiring in us that knows how to do that instinctively, unconsciously. I think where it gets tricky is when we have a mismatch between the present context and when that survival response is needed, or when the disembodiment occurred as a result of what was previously overwhelming. And then, right, it just kind of hung around. Now, even that though, I would say, I would never blame a person for it hanging around, because what's it still doing? It's protecting from the overwhelming load of distress that still lives inside of them. Mm-hmm. And why do we need to do that? Except if we don't feel like we have the space or time or resources or support to actually face what we had to disconnect from in the first place.
Yeah.
And then we have this other realm of disembodiment. I'm kind of referencing it here in this conversation in terms of the trauma response dissociation kind of sphere, but we would also more clinically and empirically see disembodiment as misattunement to body cues, or harming of the self behaviors, or treating oneself as an object. So they would be less in the realm of neutral, I'm not feeling my body, I'm disconnected, and more perhaps even active perpetration against our own bodies. But even that, like, I have such appreciation and compassion for what that is doing in a person's system, because no organism is wired to hurt itself, right? Again, if we imagine that our wiring is around flourishing, survival and flourishing for sure, both together, that when an organism turns on itself, there's a specific function there, right? It's doing something that's not on our natural state. Nature doesn't do that to itself. So our bodies are nature. So we have to ask the question, well, what's it doing when people are misattuned to their cues, or what happens when people are hurting themselves? And we can start to come back to that definition that I was saying earlier about, you know, this kind of the self or the mind being this relational encounter with us and others that shapes what it feels like to be us inside. And we meet very closely in the examples that I'm thinking of, the experience that people have of needing to hurt themselves as a means to manage the pain they're in, or because they were not given any other resources or tools, or perhaps a person misattuning to their own bodily cues, like, I'm tired, but I'm going to stay up all night because I need to work harder. Or, you know, I have an injury, but I'm going to keep pushing to do that exercise routine because I want to lose the weight, or whatever it is. Like, why is it that we do that? Why do we hurt ourselves or misattune in that way? Well, probably because we weren't ever shown how to attune.
Right.
And that we could be in connection and be loved and valuable if we stayed connected to our cues. So often all of this is held in this relational sphere that often, you know, isn't immediately aware to us in the moment. You know, the person that decides to say, you know, they're ordering at the restaurant and they say, I'm going to order this thing because I think it has, you know, kind of the caloric composition that I'm interested in versus that other thing that I think I kind of actually really want. The person might not be in that moment thinking about their childhood relational experiences that shape the fabric of that choice, but that's there in their nervous system. It's wired into what feels like an appropriate option, what's going to get me love, what's going to help me feel safe in my community. So there's just, you know, there's such complexity here. But I think to come back to the question, what I'm really wanting to emphasize is I don't think any of the disembodiment or the management strategies are bad.
Yeah.
Right? They just might not make sense for us given our present day reality, but even the reason that they continue is probably because we don't know if we have other options. We don't know if we'll be loved if we choose something else.
Gosh, that's so kind. I love how in your book, you allow entry at every level and then progress at every level. It feels like one giant yoga class where you're like, here is a modification if this feels like it's too much.
Yeah.
So I love that so much. Before we get into actual embodiment, I have one more question about disembodiment, which is, I feel like it is almost impossible to unlink our bodies with how they look. It feels like work. Unlinking those things feels like work that is consistently booby-trapped and never over once it's over. The lessons that we learn along the way, it feels inextricably linked with how they look. Do you have any advice for getting deeper into our bodies and what they mean and what they do for us besides just that?
Yeah. You know, this is such an interesting tension. And whenever we're looking at really the philosophical literature about the origins of embodiment, as we understand them academically, what we can see is that people have wrestled with this tension for a long time. Like, how do we deal with the fact that we're visible? How do we deal with the fact that people are going to have thoughts and feelings about what they see, about how visible we are? Like, what do we do with that? How do we live with that as a reality without it necessarily becoming this thing that dominates our identity? And I think, you know, I have such an appreciation for the complexity of visibility of bodies, because I think it's really easy when we're in appearance management dominated spaces. Yoga classes, unfortunately, are often one of them.
Absolutely.
They've been co-opted that way. But we think about diet culture in general, and it seems like appearance is often thought of as this thing that we have to change to manage. But appearance is also so much more than that. It's, you know, if you were to walk into a room and see someone you love, right, you would know that they were that person that you love because you saw them. Or perhaps there is a look on a person's face that tells you something about their inner world, right? It's the visibility of that look that communicates about the inside. Or we could even say, this is like, you know, it's dating me a little bit in terms of how I was parented, but if you have your skirt tucked into the back of your pantyhose, not that anybody wears, like, I haven't actually said the word pantyhose in probably 15 years. Like, yeah. it's been ejected from the cultural vernacular, but the reality is, like, it's another person who goes, hey, honey, you got to fix your skirt. Yeah. It's, we all have a backside, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. We have a place where the tag pops out of our shirt and someone goes, hey, I'm just going to tuck that in for you. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally different way of looking at appearance to think about it as being an access point for love and care as well, right? And not just us objectifying ourselves so that ideally we're perceived as good enough in the eyes of culture and someone else, so then we feel safe and good and loved enough. We can also have a way of interacting with appearance in a broader sense by just thinking about, like, how it is to see and be seen, which again, take us into this non-beauty driven way of encountering the visibility of another person.
Right.
Even this practice of mirror work, I have at various seasons of my life, it's not an active practice right now, but like sat in front of the mirror and just looked at my own eyes, you know, for 10, 15 minutes, right? Just staring at my own face to really see myself and to feel what it's like to return to myself the gaze that I offer to others. And that's a practice that has to do with being visible, with appearing, with having a skin, with having a look a certain way. And then I would say, just because it's important whenever we're talking about embodiment to also talk about the politics of the body, visibility in terms of which bodies we see and which bodies we don't see is also something to pay attention to when it comes to seeing and appearance. Are there fat bodies? Are there Black bodies? Are there Indigenous bodies? Are there queer bodies? Are there bodies that have disability? Are there bodies that have of different size and different age? Are there bodies of different gender? So when we're looking at what it is to be seen and to see, we also want to look past, again, am I adhering to appearance standards, right? Yeah. Am I meeting the expectation of what beauty looks like? And think more broadly in terms of, you know, is everybody seen? Is everybody visible? And if not, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, did you have more?
I was just going to say, tell me what your original question was, because I took a tangent.
Who even cares? This is great. Okay. So I lived in Japan for 3 years. And one of my more beautiful life experiences was going to these onsens, and they had them divided up. So they're natural springs, and they were divided up into a women's wing and a men's wing. And you strip down buck naked, and you would get into these hot springs with strangers, very, very, very much naked. And it was the most beautiful experience because no one there met any standard of conventional beauty. Mm-hmm. We were all so many different shapes and sizes. And we were all, because we were all feeling a little bit of the same thing, which is probably a mix of vulnerability and pride. Vulnerability because we're bearing it all, and then pride because we're bearing it all. You know, we're doing it anyways. So there's this camaraderie, and it was just one of the, I mean, I can, a lot of times when I'm mad at humanity, because that's happening, you know, more than it used to, but there are these moments that I return to again and again to remind myself that we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them. It was just women being together without any judgment at all.
That's it.
Just warm acceptance. We're all so beautiful. Oh, I love that so much. I end my yoga classes with, you know, giving a moment of thanks for your body, what it allowed you to do today and how it allows you to serve and who it allows you to love. And so what I hear you saying in so many ways and in so many topics that we've covered is that if this isn't a practice, the world will have its way with you. Mm. You know, we're simply absorbing too much societal information that we can just get tossed about by all of the things that we're consuming and absorbing. And so practices are necessary. So that said, I would like to talk about embodiment, wisdom of the body. Did you intend for practices to go along with wisdom? Because to me, they are so lovely together, because a lot of times I feel like we can see and we can agree, yes, there's a disconnect, but what do I do? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what to do about it. And this, I don't know how people are using it. I'm curious what kind of feedback you've gotten. But for me, sometimes I will do one question because, oh, that got deep. And that's all I have capacity for that day. And then other days I will do a whole page. And but I'm using it as a guided journal. It's a little bit here, it's a little bit there. It accepts me right where I am and right, you know, how far I'm willing to go. So I'm deeply appreciative. But how are you hearing that people are using it? What's the feedback that you've gotten?
I'll answer that first question too about the process. Did I intend for it to go along with the, you know, the wisdom of your body? The process for me of coming into embodiment was first through my mind. It was like I had to learn about it in a research context before I understood that though this was actually something I needed to practice. It was like, if my mind is the place where I live, it would also make sense that that would be the first place that I would encounter a new idea or a new way of thinking or being. And so I made the assumption that most people in North America who are reading my work are probably approaching this the same way, that they encounter an idea and then they allow it to perhaps shift a value and then maybe change a behavior and then maybe change the way they interact or practice and maybe see the value of a practice. And so they have the buy-in, the mental buy-in to then engage in the practice. And it was actually always, always my hope to write or produce or you know, dispense into the world practices for embodied living. But it, can you imagine how strange or backwards it would have been for so many of us if I offered that first? There would have been like perhaps not an appetite for it, because we would have to be convinced first this is meaningful.
Right.
So the order is a way that I think reflects that how as a society we meet new material often. But it's also kind of an interesting, there's something for me about writing the wisdom of your body where I thought this is so incomplete if I just give people new ideas about the body. I really want for people to meet themselves, and I want to take out of my hands the keys to their self-knowing. And I want to put them back in people's hands. And so really the idea with practices for embodied living is that instead of me being the, you know, I would never call myself this, but it's a helpful trope to use, like the guru or the wise person who's like, here's what, you know, you should know about your body, really I'm wanting to say is no, actually the thing that I was trying to say all along, you get to experience that. And here are some doors to pull on, some handles to pull on to help you be with that.
Yeah. It isn't a book to read. It's a book to use.
Yeah. And that's to your second question. That's what I'm asking of people really in the way that it's set up is it's not really like a traditional book. It's more like a workbook or more like a, guided practices. I mean, I can't think of better language than that to describe it, but my hope, and I'm starting to see this a little bit, is that people would actually use it in group contexts, that people would use it in yoga classes, that people would use it in their Bible studies, that they would use it in their small groups, in their team workshops, in their retreats, in their, their gatherings or their ceremonies, that there would be things that people could do that would bring them into creating new mini cultures of more attuned embodied living. Mm-hmm. And so not just doing this kind of in the privacy of our home, but also like, hey, we're starting a meeting. Could we try one of these practices? Could we do that together as a way to connect to our knowing before we launch into, the AGM or the whatever it is, where we often have these experiences of just kind of, again, living in our minds together. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's ultimately what I think is at the heart of how you set up the question, that if we're not taking active steps to resist some of the stories that culture is giving us, then the tide is going to encroach on us and it's going to be really easy to be swallowed into even more disembodiment. But we have to remember that culture in its ubiquity is made up of us, and that when we do different things and when we do different things collectively, we create new culture.
That's right.
And so I want for people to move into collective spaces and group spaces and conversations with friends and discourse on social media, posting about their practices, sharing things so that we can change the culture together, which I think we have the power to do. And I think we have the stamina to do when we are actually paying attention to our bodies as well.
I love that so much. I am reminded of this story. This is how I knew that I wanted to I had practiced yoga before, but how I knew I wanted to lead and teach was because I had gone to this was 16 years ago, but I had gone to a mom's group, and it was led by a pretty, I don't know, strict nun. She was a little on the serious side, but there were about five of us and we would gather pretty religiously, pretty regularly. And I always left, as I grew up Protestant and was now in a Catholic space. And so I always left feeling like this hyper-friendly, Protestant person that came in and talked too much. I would always leave a little sad at myself. And one day she had us take some deep breaths together to start the meeting. And it was a little awkward because there weren't very many of us there. And I am telling you that there was something about the silence and the stillness and performing life's most basic function right next to a stranger that seemed to unite us, that made me just want to place my hand on her knee. Mm-hmm. And it was probably the most productive session that we had ever had. I mean, no one had a lobotomy or anything. We were still us, but there was just something unlocked about, and so I think of that, of normalizing being in a body, normalizing these things that are functional and good, and incorporating them into our everyday spaces and seeing what it does, seeing how we can be more attuned to ourselves, honest with ourselves. Yeah. Healing and whole.
And I think that this is the end result of embodiment, is what you just described, is when we are paying attention to our bodies, slowing down to take a breath, and we hear our neighbor take a breath, we go, oh, we're not so different.
Nah.
Oh, actually the same thing that's animating breath in you is animating breath in me. Mm. And I want to treat you like that. Mm. Like, I think that there's a process of nature recognizing itself in nature that emerges when we slow down. And I think that the end result of that, again, this would be my bias and assumption about humanity here, is that nature knows how to be in relationship with itself. Gosh. And so I think that when we are with ourselves in this way, when we remember the substrate of our existence, which is our materiality, which is our kind of our enfleshedness, and we see that in our neighbors, I think that good things happen. I think it brings us into connection.
What a beautiful place to end. Before we talk about where to follow and how to support you, do you mind telling us what you're hopeful for?
Oh my gosh, so many things all the time. I have like a, I wouldn't call it a pathology around hope, but it's unrelenting. I'm like,
unrelenting hope. That is lovely.
Yeah. And I think right now, I mean, just because it's, I'm looking at my tree out the window and I just did this in bulk or Bridget's Day ritual around tying string to the tree to represent the seeds of aliveness inside of us. I'm looking at the tree and all of the fabric strips that we tie to the tree. And I'm thinking about how aliveness is unfolding and emerging inside of me. And there is a version of me that I will become in a year from now that I haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to know her. Mm-hmm. And so I think what makes me hopeful is that there is this kind of constant unfolding and development that is just wired into our being. And there is so much more to discover about who I am that I haven't met yet, but I know that I will.
Gosh, what a beautiful answer. The learning and the unlearning and then the new learning. Mm-hmm. It's just our life's journey. Thank you so much. Where can we follow? What can we do to lift our voices and support you and tell others? Where do you want us to gather?
Yes. So on social media and Twitter and Facebook, you can find me. So I'm usually some combination of Hillary Leanna McBride or Hillary L. McBride. I've got a website, hillarylmcbride.com. And I love to speak and lead groups and retreats and go places. But I think one of the best things that you can do as an author for me is to help people find my books. And the way to do that, I would say, is like request them at your library, gift them, but also to review them, to rate and review them online. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean you have to think it's a perfect book, but just based on how things go in the book world these days, that when people read and review books, it's actually really, really helpful for authors. So if you can do that, encourage your friends to do that. That makes a big difference for us.
Consider it done.
Thank you.
It's such an honor. It's such an honor to host you. I have to be honest that I was a little bit nervous and I just appreciate your generosity. Mm-hmm. You're such a caretaker. You're so nurturing and I appreciate your voice in this world. I hope you never quit writing and thinking and asking good questions. I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you. Thank you. What a treat to be with you today.
Hello, Beefinator.
Hi, Beefy Beef. Oh, girl, this conversation was a doozy. Was deep.
It really was. And I feel like Hillary is such a pro when it just on this topic. And it if her content is rich online, it is even deeper in person, like in a conversation like this. Yeah, it was really great.
I was feeling, and as I was listening, that I'm certainly guilty of ignoring my body or, I mean, at least like putting it off.
Yeah. I'm doing better, but for sure, me too. Yeah.
Yeah. As I was listening to y'all, I was trying to get to like underneath why, right? Like, I don't feel a particular hatred for my body or really strong feelings anyway.
Why you're ignoring it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't love it either, but I don't have bad feelings about it. So, I mean, why would I ignore it? I don't know.
So I just went through this process, like really sat with it. So I'm really curious to hear if you got underneath it at all. I did a little bit.
Well, I mean, my answer is super boring, but yes. I mean, the truth is, Beef, like, I just don't have time. And apparently I don't want to make time, right? Like, I don't have time to be attentive and loving and caring and make appointments for one more thing, right? And like, I know how that sounds, especially like thinking about saying it publicly, but it's just how it feels, right?
Yeah.
Like the other day I had this moment where I was like walking too fast by a door, like with my bag, you know, and it got caught on the on the doorknob. Yeah. And I was trying to like take off without it and I got yanked back, right? And like now it cracks me up. But in the moment, like that abruptness made me want to rage. Not make me want to rage. It made me rage.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that. Like how that's totally counter to my normal personality, right? Like I'm usually pretty steady.
Yeah.
At least I try to be.
Yeah.
But I was curious about that. Like why? Like why did that small thing at the end of the day make me feel so much and so big and so contrary to how I think I usually am.
Well, I don't think that it's entirely your fault, because I think those things always happen when you're in a bad mood.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had this realization later after thinking about it more, just like a thought process, and wondered if I had really just been feeling like a low level of irritability all day and just had been ignoring it. Right. And then that thing is like the thing that just like pushed me over the edge.
Yeah.
So then I'm thinking like, am I either numb and ignoring or jittery and explosive? Right. There's like one extreme or the other, but surely there's a healthier middle.
I feel like if Hillary were here, right here in the middle of us, she would congratulate that posture of curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, of like, why? What's that about? And really leaning into all that. I think those questions are huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate feeling encouraged to wonder. And then someone like normalizing what we're kind of, that we're just bad at this, right? But we can be better.
Yes. So, okay. So my instance, it's different, but I don't know, maybe similar. So I am ignoring also. And I feel like mine has a lot to do with slipping into a mindset where like my body is a machine. Mm. And yes, it might need maintenance, but that can easily be put off because it's just a machine.
Right, right. And not like spiritual or sacred.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so how that looks for me is if I have carved out silence and space, then I will go through a laundry list of like, how am I doing? You know, I will take stock, like inventory. So how much sleep have I had this week? You know, when's the last time I pooped? How am I breathing? Right. So like, when I think about how full our lives are. So you're saying like, you don't have time. Like for sure, my busyness is a badge. For sure, my to-do list is like some kind of trophy or something. Mm-hmm. But when I am ignoring the most basic parts of having a body, like that's just plain housekeeping, you know?
And we know how you love housekeeping.
So of course I'm ignoring it, right? So
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But it is because I am making the mistake of seeing my body as not this complicated marvel, but instead like this perfunctory thing that like either needs to work or doesn't, you know?
Like a machine.
A machine. And it goes against everything Hillary's talking about.
Right. Because I mean, what she was talking about is that about our bodies having wisdom, right? And there's no wisdom in a machine.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And when so I was kind of sitting with that ignoring, what does that mean? What is that about? And is there a level of fear underneath it? Is this about fear? What am I afraid of? Mm. Am I afraid of being too good of a listener? And am I afraid of what I will find in that process of avoidance?
Because then what?
I don't know. It's like, you know, I can be afraid of my feelings because I'm afraid I'm going to be hijacked by them. You know, like I'm afraid that I might have to confront something or change something.
Or decide something, right? Yeah.
Yes. Do something that requires a certain amount of discipline that I don't want to do, but I know that I probably should. Yeah.
Right. Or deal with the unknown.
Yes. And so it's silence to me is such a revealer. It's only in that carved space that I'm like really even starting to take on body as machine. Oh, maybe body as wise, you know?
It's so hard to get silence, right? Like we even fall asleep to TV and podcasts.
Don't come after my true crime beef. Don't do it.
I would never. But to me, like the biggest win is that, like you were saying, curiosity is kind of the hardest part, right? So just stopping, stilling, listening, agreeing that the work is important is the first step. Mm-hmm. And I think that she, like Dr. Hilly, really kind of maps out the rest in the book. So here's how to get still. Here are the questions to ask. Here's how to breathe.
Right. Right. Yes. Having well-worn paths, because she's been doing this a long time. She's uber smart. And so like, oh, you're curious. Oh, you want to be better? Here's my book.
Right. Right. It's good.
So is there a new practice that you have incorporated?
Yeah, I hope and think that she would appreciate my efforts. So I don't know that I'm ready to be silent or alone, but my practice is music and asking for the Holy Spirit. So I have, this is the Lenten practice for me. So every morning in Lent, I have made it a practice to listen to the song, Holy Spirit, You're Welcome Here by Jesus Culture. And so it's just a really quiet, like centering song for me to just be aware of. It's a centering song for me and just to be aware of some stillness and the Holy Spirit, right? And so it talks about, let us become more aware of your presence. Let us experience the glory of your goodness. And it just, that is repeated. And I think just that focus on presence has been a really, really good way to start my day. And then I find myself being more aware throughout the day.
Yeah.
What about you?
I have been doing some breath prayers at red lights.
Ooh.
So inhale, thy kingdom come. Exhale, my kingdom go. Yeah. All right. Love you, Beef. Thanks.
Love you. Bye.
I am so, so grateful for you, listener. If you liked this episode, could you please do me a favor and hit subscribe and leave a review? It really helps the show grow, and I would be so appreciative. Thank you so much to our guests who share their gifts so generously with us, and a special thank you to Taylor Schroll, who does so much behind the scenes to make the show great. If it weren't for him, I would still be in my closet with my iPhone. You can follow along at Forte Catholic as well. That's Taylor's show where I show up now and again. And to keep up more regularly, please follow along on Instagram at Allison M. Sully or TikTok at Sullivan Family TikTok. See you next week.
Today's show was a production of Allison Sullivan in conjunction with the Forte Catholic Podcast Network. For more great Catholic podcasts, head on over to fortecatholic.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.